Okay, it's 8 o'clock, and according to our schedule, we're kind of planning to do a little bit of chanting, like 10 minutes, and then a Q&A session. And the thing is, you asked so many beautiful questions. I've quickly read through them, and they're so good and so fun that I know I will not be able to answer all of them. So the question is whether we should make the chanting short so we can just go on straight to the Q&As. How do you feel? Chanting or not chanting at all, or a little bit of chanting? What do you want? Q&A? Straight to Q&A? Anybody against? No. Okay, then we basically for tonight we dropped the chanting. Those who were able to come this early morning, they got some chanting. So we just dropped it this morning, this evening. Okay, so I have already very quickly read through all of them, and I have taken out a couple of them because they're basically too big questions to answer in an hour's session in the evening. But one question here is one of the most beautiful questions I've kind of come across for a long, long, long time, and the question goes like this: how can I deal with doubt? And whoever wrote that question is already showing how wise he is, but I don't think he knows it himself. How can I deal with doubt? You ask questions. And that's what he's doing. So this person here is always showing how wise he is. He has doubt, but he started to kind of chew into it and find answer to his doubt. My interpretation here is the word doubt in a Buddhist spiritual setting. And doubt is a big hindrance for a spiritual development, and it only ends at a very high stage of development, something which we call for stream winning, which is what we can call an attainment, where doubt disappears completely from your mind. Because basically you know what this is about, what was it the Buddha was trying to teach, you know what's going on, so there isn't any doubt anymore. To get there takes a while. That takes a lot of effort, and up till that point, you will have doubt in your mind. And the answer is that until you know yourself, the best thing you can do is to find sources of information, which you can try to find the best source of information and listen and try to understand. So I think the Buddha, he would typically say that you have to mingle with wise people. You have to try to find people or monks or spiritual people who are wiser than yourself. And then you can stay with them and you can listen to them. And you can also read books. There are very good translations of the teachings of the Buddha. So whatever you do to try to overcome your doubt will help. But it will be there for a long, long, long time. But at one point, it will disappear. And to be able to do that, you need deep meditation, and you need a thorough understanding of the Buddha's teaching until there is this first stage of enlightenment, the first stage of awakening, which is big stuff. So my answer here is try to find the best guides you can. The best spiritual monks and teachers, the best books, the most authentic books. Read, study, listen, and then you have to find a solution. You have to find the answer yourself. All the teachers and all the books, they can only guide you towards development. And this doubt will only disappear when you know yourself. But this one, I say, who is asking this question is already wise. He's already start to ask the question, to find the answer. So he's already proving that he's wise. There is, I think I have it here. There is a couple of a little bit funny sayings. When in doubt, doubt the doubt. Don't believe in your doubt. Just continue the development until you understand yourself. Doubt is just a hindrance in yourself, which makes your mind spinning. It doesn't lead anywhere. Just continue your practice until you understand yourself. And there's another saying. This is a bit long, and maybe I have to read it out a couple of times. Doubt is a pain too lonely to know that faith is his twin brother. Doubt is a pain too lonely to know that faith is his twin brother. So you can say that if you have doubt, then try to develop some faith. This Buddhist tradition have existed for 2,500 years. A lot of people have been using this as a guide in life to develop yourself spiritually and mentally. It's a reason why it existed for 2,500 years and still exists. So if you're in doubt, maybe you can try to do things which increases your faith as like an opposite. Okay. Wow, thank you, Ajahn. P.S. Is there any way the monks can adapt the black cow? That's this reference to this what I said this morning, that we have a black cow here, which is what our guest right now, until we find a new home for it. Maybe it's not me. Maybe it's not his time, and he was smart enough to escape. No, monks cannot adapt a cow, basically. And we have far too much to do already. We even have to say no to a cat, so we can't take a cow. How effective is to do meditation using guiding voice and music? Guiding voice can be a really good idea. And I have decided that tomorrow, during the 8 o'clock, 8:30 session. I will do a guided session, guided meditation session for everybody who wants to come. A little bit of theory and then a guided meditation. Because a guided voice, a guided meditation can lead you down a road which you can't, if you don't kind of find your way yourself. And that's why when the monks go to Armadale and teach there, we do a lot of guided meditation, because it kind of leads you in the right direction so you can have a taste. So somebody else can kind of lead you into yourself and find peace. And then based on your own experience, you can do it yourself later. But music, if you use music as part of a meditation, that will be very superficial. It may be help, it maybe will give you some kind of feeling of wellness, etc. But it will be also a disturbance to your mind. So it will maybe calm down your mind, but it also creates a lot of waves and thoughts and emotions, and especially if the music contains singing, so there's words, you create a lot of hindrances by using that. So if you want to use some music, maybe some, what do you call it, instrumental music? So say nobody singing, it's just some calming music. You can do that, but it's better without. Meditation seems very solitary. How to cope with this? And that answer is very simple. We have a senior monk or a spiritual director, an abbot of a monastery. And quite many years ago, he did a 6 months retreat, solitary. And he actually stayed in one of the huts there, and nobody came and talked to him for 6 months. And he said that I think he saw one monk at one time coming with food for him. So really full-on meditation, really deep, really, really is solitary. But it is solitary because you will end up wanting it to be solitary. Because if you learn properly to meditate, if you develop your virtue, your generosity, and your kindness, and you learn this thing we call meditation, and to let go, and you learn to let go of the things around you, you will fall into your mind. And as I've been trying to talk or say, when you do this properly, there are a delight arising in your mind, which is a pure mental delight. It's a delight independent of your body. And that delight is much, 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 much stronger than anything you can squeeze out of your body. So those monks who can live solitary for a long, long time, they're doing it because they love it. Because they get so much energy, wisdom, peace, even enlightenment and awakening out of that, they wish to be solitary. They find that better than being social. But this, of course, demands that you have developed yourself so that when you are solitary, you can calm down your mind. There is joy, there is rapture, there is bliss, energy arising, which makes meditation so fun that you only want to do that. And you do it for hours after hours, day after day. And you lift your mind so high up in terms of energy and lightness that you don't want to do anything else. It's such a sublime practice. And you have to kind of, to get them out of retreat, you just have to go there and just drag them out of the huts because they want to continue to be there because it's so fun. So the only way, it seems like a solitary thing and it maybe seems sad, but it's the complete opposite. These monks who really meditate and are solitary and live by themselves for a long, long time, They're doing it because they absolutely love it. And they get so much out of it. So it's easy to cope with. They want to do it. There's no need to coping it. They love to do it. So if you don't love it yet, and you're kind of learning to meditate, and when you learn to do this meditation, and it seems solitary, so maybe it seems a bit sad or it's kind of negative in the beginning, it's just because you haven't learned to do this properly yet. But as you learn to do it, you start to see the beautiful things about this, and then you will want to start to do it yourself. So just hang in there. Yeah, it might seem solitary and maybe a bit negative, but it's not. When I feel angry, I find it challenging to stop thoughts from the person, situation. I'm angry about from arising while I meditate. So, okay, probably I feel angry and I find it challenging to stop my thoughts when I probably think of some person or situation. How can we share any thoughts on how to stop this rumination, all these negative thoughts? So basically, what is the antidote for ill will? It's loving kindness. So if your mind is, if you're full of anger, you have to learn to do loving kindness meditation. And tomorrow we'll touch on loving kindness meditation. Learn they call it metta in this old Pali language. Learn metta meditation, loving kindness meditation. And then you find a tool to remove your anger. How do you know you have entered deep meditation? And can you share your deep meditation experience? How do you know? Okay, first, can you share your deep meditation? The thing is that the monks, we are living under like a code of conduct. We're following some rules and regulation how we are to behave. And there's a rule prohibiting us from talking about deep meditation to lay people. So, and that is from the limit there is jhana. So if there is a monk who really does jhana, he's basically not allowed to share that experience to people outside the group of monks. But you can talk about your meditation experiences up to that point. And there is so much to talk about all the way up to that point that there's not a problem. There is so much joy. There is so much energy, there is so much positive things happening in meditation that it's not really a problem that we can't talk about deep meditation. So I can maybe share something, but not about the deepest meditation practices, because we're not allowed to do that. But how do you know you have entered deep meditation? And then the question is, what is deep meditation? What do you mean? If you define deep meditation as the Buddha defined as jhanas, sama samadhi, you will know that because you will, if you read books and listen to teachings about monks who have really good meditation and deep meditation, they say that deep meditation is extremely blissful, really mind-blowingly blissful. So if you have entered a state where your mind is just extremely full of bliss and lightness and energy, and a lot of your attention towards things around you has faded away, so you're just inside of yourself and awareness of your body and the world around you had faded away. So you're just inside of yourself in a beautiful place with a lot of peace and bliss and energy, which is really, 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 really strong. And the deeper you go, the stronger it gets. So if you like our teacher, the abbot of the monastery, he uses this comparison. If you find a meditation which is much stronger than a sexual orgasm, and much, much, much stronger than that, then maybe we can start talking about deep meditation. Can you share a meditation experience with deep? Okay, this is pre-jhana. This isn't really deep meditation, but it can give you some perspective. I remember when I was a young monk and I was practicing a lot and staying in my hut. I had a lot of contact with my brother. He was also very interested in spirituality, so we had a lot of conversation about spirituality and meditation and development. And I remember as a really young monastic, then having kind of recent memories of living in a relationship and doing all the normal things with romance and sex and all those relationships and the pleasures of that was kind of close and recent to my mind. But what I found, which is start when your mind starts to calm down, I told my brother that when I meditated, I got into states where the mind gave me more pleasure. For every in-breath I had, I was doing breath meditation, and I managed to connect my focus on breath on this feeling of bliss. So as I breathed in, there was kind of energy and bliss arising in my mind, and as I was breathing out, it kind of faded away. And then I was breathing in again, that lifted up energy and feelings of bliss and joy in my mind again. So I'm breathing in and then out, and in and out, and in and out. And for every in-breath, there arose in me bliss, and every in-breath was stronger than a sexual orgasm. And I was sitting there and lying there and just enjoying that for an hour. And that is not jhana. That's below, far below a jhana. So if you do this practice, if you develop yourself to be a good person, a virtuous person, a generous person, and you learn to meditate, what will happen when peace takes hold of your mind, when you're able to calm down and calm down, just like this water simile I was talking about, the water pool. If you can calm down your mind by focusing on a meditation object, and you have the virtue of the goodness in you from the past, from your normal life, what we call bliss or energy will arise. And that mental energy or bliss is so strong in itself that it makes it better than having a sexual relation. And that's open for everybody to do. So if you want to say deep meditation, you're going into an area of experiences which is really mind-blowing. It's really, really, really strong stuff. And just as our teacher said once, that's an experience which you never, ever will forget the rest of your life. That's how strong it is. Okay, I don't usually come on retreats as I feel I need to get stuff done and achieve. This is from comparing myself to other people. How can I stop comparing myself to others? Okay, I have an answer for you. I'll read out a short story. This is a story from the spiritual director of PSWA, Ajahn Brahm. So now we just read it out. When I was 14 years old, I was studying on for my O-level exams in a high school in London. My parents and teachers advised me to stop playing soccer in the evenings and weekends, to stay at home, giving the time to my homework. They explained how important the O-level exams were, that if I did well, I'll be happy. I followed their advice and did really well, but it didn't make me happy, because my success meant that now I must study even harder, for another 2 years for the A-level exams. My parents and teacher advised me to stop going out in the evenings and weekends, so stop chasing the girls now rather than chasing the football. And to stay at home and study. They told me, the parents, how important the A-level exams were, and if I did well, then I would be happy. Once again, I followed their advice and did really well. But once again, it didn't make me happy, because now I had to study harder, the hardest of all, for 3 more long years for a degree at university. My mother and teacher advised me to stay clear of the bars and parties in college, but instead to work hard and long at my studies. They told me how important a university degree was, and that if I did well, then I will be happy. At that point, I started to become suspicious. I saw some of my older friends who had worked very hard to get their degree. Now they were working even harder in their first job. They were working extremely hard to save up enough money to buy something important, for example, a car. And they told me, when I have enough money to buy a car, then I will be happy. When they had enough funds and had bought their first car, they still weren't happy. Now they were working hard to buy something else, and then they'll be happy. Or they were struggling in the turmoil of romance, looking for a partner in life, and they told me, when I get married and settle down, then I will be happy. Once married, they still weren't so happy. They had to work even harder, even take extra jobs to save up enough money for a deposit for a house or apartment. They told me, when we have bought our own house, then we will be happy. Unfortunately, paying off the monthly installment for the house loan meant that they still weren't happy. Moreover, they now start a family. They would have children to wake them up at night, swallow up all their spare money, and increase their worries in quantum leaps and bounds. Now it will be another 20 years before they can do what they wanted to do. So they told me, when the kids are grown up and left the home, then I will be happy. By the time the kids had left the home, most of the parents were staring at retirement. So they continued to postpone their happiness, working hard to save for their old age. And they told me, when I retire, then I will be happy. Even before I retired, and certainly after, they started becoming religious and going to church. Have you ever noticed how many old people occupying the church? I asked them why they were not going to church, and they told me, because when I die, then I'll be happy. For those who believe that when I get this, then I will be happy, their happiness will just be a dream in the future. It'll be like a rainbow, one or two steps ahead, but forever just out of reach. They will never in their life or after realize happiness. So whoever it is here who doesn't want to come and retreat because there's so much stuff to be done and so much to achieve, and this is from comparing myself to other people, how can I stop this comparing to myself? What do you think that what other people are doing will make you happy? So stop comparing yourself to other people, because they don't know what is right for you. Vene Bonito, many thanks for stepping in to teach this retreat. No problem. Okay. Dear Ajahn, what has surprised you most about monastic life? Oh. Honestly, what has surprised me the most is how rewarding this type of spiritual life is. Because it's so, if you really do this well and really try and you have a good teacher and you put your whole life on the line like a bhikkhu does or should do, and I have tried to do, what has surprised me is how giving, how much you get out of this, how rewarding it is, and how much a nice life this is. Even though I don't have a girlfriend anymore, I don't have any money, I don't have a house, I don't have a car. I have a hut, which is like, I'm boring a hut, which is six square meters in the forest, without power or electricity, without water. And I work for free. And what I suppose surprised me the most is how much you get out of life by being a bhikkhu. And it's coming from learning to be a really good person, learning to meditate and lift up your mind and create happiness, mental happiness and joy inside, and use that to develop wisdom, which creates an even more beautiful mind. Please, could you pod your wisdom? Please, can you pod your wisdom about maintaining stability awareness? Okay, please, can you say something wise about maintaining stability awareness? Basically, what you're looking for is to gain stability awareness or stability of mindfulness. Stability awareness arises by itself. And it arises by letting go. You can't do anything. You can't change anything. You can't put in effort to create stability. You can't make your mind stable, or your mindfulness stable. That stableness arises out of letting go. to remove all the hindrances and all the activities of your mind. And what you're left with is a pure mind with no disturbances. And then there's nothing to disturb your awareness. And then you get a really good, strong awareness because you just remove the hindrances. So this idea of stability, of awareness, or mindfulness, it comes by itself. Your job is to allow your mind to experience meditation and mindfulness by getting out of the way. Stop interfering. Do your meditation. Try as well as you can to let go and let your mind calm down. And as your mind calms down, stability, awareness, and mindfulness will come by itself. Step in the beginning, you can call that peace. And it's something really beautiful. How can... can contemplation, particular of nature, be a kind of meditation? So contemplation of nature, can that be a kind of meditation? The answer is yes. On many levels. For basically, what you say, this is actually what you're supposed to do to get deep insights. You are supposed to contemplate nature, how life works. You're supposed to develop your goodness, your virtue, lift up your mind with meditation, and you're supposed to contemplate nature through the glasses, through the lenses of the Buddha, the teachings of the Buddha. And you contemplate nature, yourself, the universe, everything. And the result of that is the arising of wisdom, real deep wisdom. So you can say that contemplation of nature is a kind of meditation. On a more beginner level is also a nice thing to do. But on a beginner level, it can be a good thing, but it can also be a disturbance. Because you end up just thinking about various things instead of first calming down your mind, empowering your mind, enabling your mind to be really strong. So when you do this contemplation, you can do it really deep and really well. So it's not wrong to do contemplation of nature in the beginning, but it can also be a hindrance for you to build up enough mind power to develop deep insights and wisdom. So you can do that, but don't overdo it. What happened to the black cow? Maybe I shouldn't have said this morning about this black cow. What happened to the black cow? I can just quickly repeat that. It was a black cow who ran away from a slaughterhouse. And somehow he managed to escape. And where did it run? It ran to all the kind monks in Serpentine for refuge. And that's all we know so far. But we don't have any... we don't know yet where we are going to... to whom we're going to give it away to. So that's the only thing we know. When I reflect on impermanence, I can feel sad that things or people I'm attached to will disappear, what we call dying. How do you contemplate impermanence without getting negative? Well, in Buddhism, you can say that you can contemplate that people are dying, which we know is a truth. But if you take the ideas of the Buddha as some kind of truth or a description of reality, a person don't really die. It's just a body who are getting used up, and you get reborn, and you will have a new life and a new body, a new vehicle. Now you have this body you have now, and it lasts so and so many years. If you're lucky, it lasts like 100 years. And then it will fall apart. But there will be a continuation. There will be a new start. It can be a new start as a human being. It can be a life as something more sublime, some divine type of life. So don't feel sad about dying. It's just nature. And it's not that they die. It's just a continuation. And there's a new type of life. New chance. New opportunities. So just try to contemplate the impermanence without getting negative. Just contemplate a little about rebirth and how life works, and see whether you can get your hand around rebirth and new existences when this body falls away. That will take away the sadness, because really it's not sad. Dying, the process of dying, or maybe if when you're older, can be a painful process because the body is just falling apart and there's pain. But as soon as the body say bye-bye, you go for a new existence and you get a new car. So don't be sad. And if you want to go all the way, if you really want to get rid of the sadness, what do you do? Again, you develop your goodness and your virtue, and you learn to meditate really, really well, and you put your uplifted, empowered mind into remembering your own previous lives. Because you can. And I know many people have done that. So you can remember your own previous lives. And if you know yourself, that you have had a life in the past, so much fear will go away. Because you know yourself. And if you have existed in the past, other people will have done the same. I am having difficulty incorporating meditation into my daily routine. Surprise, surprise. I find that both meditation in the morning and before I go to bed conduces me to fall asleep. Any suggestions? I will actually answer that question, but I will answer that together with another answer, another question I have. So I'll put that aside for now. Can I practice walking meditation at home? Of course you can. I live in a small one-bedroom apartment. How can I go about it? It's no difference. Same way as you're doing it here. Just another environment. If you can find a stretch in your house which is long enough, just as these rooms we have here on the sides, just do the same as you're doing here. There's no difference. I don't see any problem with that. But if you're, of course, if your bedroom or if your apartment is too small, so it's like 4 meters back and forth and back and forth, then maybe, I don't know, maybe you should go somewhere else and do it. And maybe you can do more sitting meditation or more walking lying meditation. But I don't see any problems with doing walking meditation at home.
Hello, Venerable. Do many monastics achieve jhanas? Thanks.
What can I say? Yes, of course.
But it's also true that jhanas are not easy to achieve. And many monastics which try to be monastic, they end up disrobing. And so they don't achieve it, basically because they give up. Deep meditations is not easy to get. It's easy to develop. But I think the answer is yes. I know enough people, even here in Perth, both lay people and monastics, who knows about this idea of jhanas and really deep meditation. So they're here in Perth, both as monastics and lay people. Quite many, actually. I've been there long enough to know roughly who they are. How do I know I'm meditating correctly? And what is the outcome for meditation? How do I know I'm meditating correctly? If you're meditating correctly, there is, and you did it long enough, you know you're meditating correctly if there is a development in your mind towards peace, tranquility, stability, joy, harmony, all these goody-goody feelings. So if there is a movement towards peace, lightness, then you do it correctly and just continue that way. But if you're meditating and you're getting more and more angry and more sad and more depressed, you're doing it the wrong way. Then then go read some books and try again. You're doing it right if your minds go towards peace and joy. And what is the outcome for meditation? Enlightenment. In end. The Buddha was teaching that you develop virtue, so you can develop your meditation, so you can develop wisdom, and that wisdom, in end, is enlightenment or awakening. The end of this spiritual goal. So don't give up. When doing walking or sitting meditation outside, is it okay to enjoy the feeling of the sun and wind on your skin? Or is enjoying it a distraction from meditation? That is perfectly fine to do as a kind of in a beginning part of like a retreat. But if you want to go deeper when your mind, for example, you go to a longer retreat, a week or 9 days, then being outside, and even as well here, a weekend retreat, being outside and just enjoying the sun and the wind is a good thing to do. Because you develop some contentment and joy and enjoying nature. And that is always calming and soothing for your mind. But at one point you have to stop that because it will create distractions. So it will hinder you to go deeper and deeper and deeper in meditation. But please do this in the beginning. So if you're in a longer retreat, you can do that for a few days. But then you back away and you try to even avoid that so you can fall deeper in. Even our abbot or the senior monk in our monastery, he's encouraging the monks to do just that. When we do our 3 months retreats every year, that's many days. And it's not an easy thing to do 3 months of a retreat. And he's basically encouraging monks to go walks in the nature, in the bush. Look at the flowers and the birds. Just enjoy nature. Because it's uplifting and it's not that disturbing. So it's a nice thing to do. So please do that. Especially in the beginning. Okay, this is about deeper meditation, the jhanas. I think that's like a heading. I believe I may have experienced a taste of the first jhana in a 9 days retreat. Recently, I read the book Right Concentration by this Leigh Brassington. It is a journey of self-discovery. Now, is it a journey of self-discovery, or is guidance required? Okay, the first thing I just quickly want to say, and that is that this idea of jhana, it is actually defined in this all this old text we can read, which we say is coming from the Buddha. But unfortunately, I know that a lot of teachers out here, out in the world, they're basically lowering the standard so they can say that that is jhana, or yes, this is jhana. But they are basically, and they know themselves, they are lowering the standards so that if you can do this, they call that for jhana, instead of following the standards we have from the Buddha, which is much, much higher up. So first, when you say that you have taste of the first jhana, then my first question is, like, how do you define the jhana? Do you define jhana as this Brassington is defining it, or you're defining it as you can see in the old text from the Buddha? And I think I can repeat a short story from Ajahn Brahm, the spiritual director of PSWA. He actually went to visit he went to the United States a few years back, and he talked to a few of those lay teachers especially in California, in the United States. And they were discussing this idea of first jhana. And they basically admitted they knew they were not teaching the real thing. But they still call it a jhana. So be a bit skeptical when people talk about jhanas, because there's so many opinions of what jhana is. So is this a journey of a self-discovery? Yeah, you can say that. This is this Buddhist spiritual path. It is a journey of discovery, discovering this idea you have about yourself. That is something you're supposed to understand. Most people have this idea about the my and me and my and an ego and a soul. And part of this journey, Buddhist journey, is to discover what is the true case in terms of me and mine and a soul and an ego. This is something to be understood. And that is basically what you do understand when you get the first stages of enlightenment, this idea of me and mine and the self. And is guidance required? Yes. Absolutely. And there's all kind of sources of guidance. There's all kind of teachers out there who can help. And there's also all these books we have, which is the teachings of the Buddha. So this journey of discovering yourself I think is a really good idea to get some guidance. Is there any significance in Buddhism as to colors visualized during meditation? Not intentionally, just colors that arise. Okay, so basically somebody's meditating and there are your mind is creating some kind of visual images of colors. and if there is any significance of that. If that is happening to you, that is normally a very good sign that your mind is going towards peace and tranquility. Because there is a stage in this meditation where your mind ends up being very playful, and it can create all kind of beautiful sceneries and beautiful things and sounds and stuff. And all of this is before jhana. So if you are able to let go a lot and you have a peaceful mind and you're kind of falling inside your mind and you're really peaceful inside yourself, quite distanced from what is happening around you. And if there is some colors, some kind of something visualized, your colors visualized popping up in front of you, that is like a little sign that you are getting somewhere. That is, of course, is going to continue this. It will disappear because this is still in disturbance. But this is minor disturbances which you still have to let go of. So if your mind is peaceful, full of energy, and you're happy inside of yourself, you're getting closer to deep meditation, then there's some, your mind is getting playful and creating all kind of fun stuff, then this is a good sign. Because this is not intentionally arisen, it's just something your mind do at a certain stage in meditation. And it's nothing to be afraid of. It's like this for everybody. Everybody I know, at least. Thank you, Ajahn. Could you please suggest three important aspects for a layperson to practice to deepen their meditation? Okay. Number one is very clear for me now after doing this for 12 years. And it's really simple. And it's so profound. And it's so simple to do. And that's to be kind. Everything you do in your life, be kind. Develop kindness to yourself. Develop kindness to your body. Develop kindness to your mind. Develop kindness to what's happening inside of you. Really, really develop kindness. Kindness is also the second factor in the Eightfold Path. Being kind and letting go. And I, after all these years, I've been trying to develop myself. Kindness is such a key. Kindness is also like oil. The best way I can put it is like if you have an engine, a car engine, and all these moving parts are moving around, and inside the engine there's oil, and because of that oil there's no friction, so all the moving parts can just move really quickly around and it doesn't get overheated. And this kindness is the oil in your mind. It takes away so much friction, both in your daily life and in your meditation. So for all these years, I've been developing myself, kindness is number one. If I'm to say two more important aspects, what's second most? But the thing is, there's so many of them. Second one is basically virtue. Precepts. To be able to do that as a layperson. Don't steal. don't lie, don't do anything kind of sexually wrong, some kind of abuse. Really put effort into being following all these precepts which are advised by the Buddha and all the wise teachers. It will take away so much suffering in your life. If you go around the life and you break these precepts, you create a lot of suffering for yourself. And by following the precepts, you avoid so much suffering, including mental suffering, remorse. So if number one is kindness, number two is virtue, precepts. And what can be the third? Yeah, the third thing can be try to find wise people in your life, or wise sources, or sources of wisdom, and use them to develop yourself. There are wise people around you. It can be your parents, it can be your some kind of spiritual leaders, it can be books. So use, find those sources of wisdom and develop yourself. Why are there many teddy bears in the meditation hall? Oh, they were there as well, yeah. This is something which started a few years ago when Ajahn Brahm, the spiritual director, I think I remember that he was teaching loving kindness meditation, and somebody brought one teddy bear, and he started to use, and he gave that, and then one person gave that to Ajahn Brahm during a retreat, and Ajahn Brahm took this teddy and put it in his kind of front of his lap, and Ajahn Brahm got up all these memories from childhood. And most people, they have a really positive association to teddy bears from childhood. So when you're even in adulthood, if you take a teddy bear and you hold it in your hand and you embrace it, a lot of those positive feelings from your childhood will come back to you. It will just recreate them inside of you. There is some safety, some goodwill, some kindness. Like a teddy bear is always smiling. Say no suffering. Everything is good. Everybody's happy. So And this just took off, and then more and more people started to give teddy bears to Ajahn Brahm. And now you see how many there are. And Ajahn Brahm is actually encouraging people Ajahn Brahm is actually encouraging people to on longer retreats to take one of these teddy bears back to your room. Do what you did when you were a kid. You can hug the teddy bear, my best friend. Because it does something with you. So Ajahn Brahm is kind of encouraging people to play with a teddy bear and see whether some of your positive emotion can arise in you again. And is something positive, is something inspiring, something which changes your mind in a positive way. And then it can help your meditation. So this is not like a 9-day retreat, so I wasn't kind of thinking of. But if you want to, take one of the teddy bears back to your room tonight and see where you can get off some of the feelings you had when you were a little kid. They can give you a little lift, some good memories, something positive, something uplifting. And the more the more of those positive emotions coming up, the more happy you will be, and the easier it will be for you to do this meditation practice. So, if you want to, go and take a teddy bear back to your room. Dear Ajahn, in your 10 years as a bhikkhu, a monk, what are the most valuable lessons you have learned? Many thanks for sharing your experience with us. What are the most valuable lessons you've learned? Yeah, I think I know the good answer for that. Before I started to do a spiritual training, and even before, being a layperson, before I ordained, before I even started anything, I was like most other people, especially in Norway, where I grew up. And I was so locked in to a view of human life, to be locked onto getting pleasure out of your body. And everything has to do with these five senses. To create comfort for your body, to work hard, you want to see something beautiful, you want to create beautiful things around you, you want to hear something beautiful. So my whole life was about maximizing the enjoyment of all the senses I have. Seeing, hearing, feeling, touching, tasting. That was my life. And that was the only thing. I took my education so I can get a good salary and have a nice job, and I can just maximize the pleasure of being a human being. And I was so ignorant to what we call the mind. And I had no idea at all that what we call the mind can also create delight and pleasure. In the same way as your body can create delight and pleasure, you can eat nice food, you can see beautiful things, you can hear beautiful music, which create a form of pleasure and delight. And I didn't know anything about creating a delight which is purely mental. And I have learned how much stronger that type of delight can be. It can be so powerful that it's much more powerful than any of the pleasures you can get out of your body. That is probably my biggest lesson, which I got the first years as a monk. That it's like, why? For those meditators who are getting some proper result in the meditation and they see how much delight and pleasure you can get just from your mind alone, they will kind of lose interest in kind of satisfying your senses. Why do you do that for? You get so much more out of you just your mind alone. The thing is, but it's kind of difficult to get there. You have to learn to do this. You have to become a good person. You have to learn to meditate. But then when you get this going and you see how amazing and how beautiful and how uplifting and how strong and beautiful your mind can be, the result is that, I can have some nice food, but I rather prioritize to create a beautiful mind. So you end up adjusting your life into make sure that your mind is beautiful, your mind is pleasurable, your mind is happy, because it's better than adjusting your life to maximize the taste of the food and the view of your eyes and the touch of your body. And that's basically what it is to be a monk. We live a simple life and we don't indulge in kind of sensory stuff. We have good food, we have a comfortable hut, we live in a beautiful nature, but we don't kind of scratch around to kind of maximize the pleasure of the body, because we either developing towards building up pleasure from your mind, or we already know that, so it's naturally you don't want to kind of scratch around in life to maximize the pleasure from your body. Hello, Nito. This is the same question. What with the Gorgias, the bears on the stage, like this one here? Can they be shared for Metta on Sunday, please? Yeah, that's the answer, yes. Tomorrow, I will do a little, I will say something about Metta, which is loving-kindness meditation, and these teddy bears, they kind of fit perfectly into that session. So that will come tomorrow. What is devotion? Devotion, probably. Basically, I don't get this question. What is devotion? Walking meditation. In an ideal world, if no restrictions, would one walk in a specific direction, north, south, north, or indifferent? In an ideal world, with no restriction, would one walk in a specific direction? Oh, this is about walking meditation, probably. Would one walk in a specific direction, either north, south, south, north, or indifferent? Ideal world? Nah, I don't think so. Or maybe I don't understand the question. Ajahn, please could you discuss the noble silence in reference to the meditation practice? Yeah, yes I can. I can say something about that. Noble silence is like a decision you take yourself if you go to a retreat. It's mostly used on longer retreats, like a 9-day retreat, or like the monks who are doing three-month retreat. You just basically decide not to talk at all. So you don't communicate, you don't talk to anybody for a period of time, some days or some weeks. You don't stop when 100%, so if somebody asks you a question, you answer, but you make this resolution that you're not going to talk to anybody. And that can be a good training, because it is a help for you to calm down your mind. It's like an extra level of restraint. Because as soon as you start to socialize and you talk to people, all kind of thoughts and emotions are triggered in you, and they start bubbling up in your meditation, and you create more problems for yourself when you want to meditate afterwards. So noble silence can be a good idea, and I've done that quite many times in the past. Not so much now, but when I was a young monk, And it helps. And it also helps if you say that you are doing noble silence on the retreat, and you tell that to everybody else, they will normally respect it. So they will not talk to you as well. So it goes both two ways. And the result of this is more peace, more distraction, less distractions, and in theory it should make your meditation easier. It's a way of restraining your senses, which will enhance your meditation. What time is it now? How are we going? 9:15. Okay. Okay. Dear Ajahn, for someone with a good intellectual understanding of Buddhism and the Buddha's teaching and the idea of non-self, how many times should such a person have a jhana experience to become a stream winner? Thank you. At least what I understand here is, I agree with what they're saying here, is that you need jhana, really deep meditation, and then you need to contemplate this idea of yourself, the idea of me and mine and the self, and that is what will give you stages of enlightenment, at least the first stage of enlightenment, which we call stream winning in English, or sotapanna in Pali. And the question is how many times you need to do jhanas to become a stream winner, and there's no answer for that. That's up to yourself. That's up to how developed you are. Because there's like a continuum. I always love to kind of tell this story from the time of the Buddha, where this queen, a royal queen at the time of the Buddha, she went to visit the Buddha in her royal kind of robes, and just popped in and listened to one talk by the Buddha. And that was everything she needed to get full enlightenment. One talk from the Buddha. That's a queen. That's really a queen. But the reason why this queen managed to get enlightened just by listening to one talk to one Buddha is because of previous development, even in previous lives. She has done so much practice and development, spiritual development in past life, that when she was reborn as a queen, close to the Buddha, she only needed the last drop of teachings from the Buddha, and she got the whole thing in 1 hour. That's a person, an example of a person which is extremely developed and just needed a little bit of teachings to get fully enlightened. And that's one end of the continuum. And the other end of continuum is somebody who has not done much practice in the past. And if they are able to learn to do meditation and learn the teaching of the Buddha and get jhanas, they probably need many, many times and many, 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 maybe many, many years, because their spiritual development in the past is weaker. So they need more. They need more jhanas, more contemplation. So it depends on where you are on this continuum. How developed are you now? How much have you done in previous lives? How far are you now? And you don't know. You just have to do this and learn to do jhana and learn the teachings of the Buddha and see how many times you need it. There isn't like one, it's not like you need one jhanas or 3.5 jhanas. It's all up to how developed you are, how far you have come so far. But according to the Buddha, if you really manage to do jhana meditation, which is extremely deep, and you contemplate the core teachings of the Buddha about non-self and self and impermanence and all that stuff, stream winning and enlightenment will arise. But I don't know. I can't say. There isn't any any answer is 1 or 2 or 10. I have not been able to get much meditations and have been feeling quite emotional. I am not usually emotional. Could you please share any thoughts on why this is? Not been able to do much meditation, have feeling quite emotional. I'm not usually emotional. Could you share any thoughts why this is? Why am I usually? Could you share any thoughts why this is? So why do I think that you've not been able to meditate much? I basically think that the reason why you're not been able to meditate much is because your mind is very, very active. There are a lot of things going on. It can be just what's happening in your life. You're going through a stretch in your life which is tough and emotional. So your mind is just more active, and it then is difficult to meditate. And then you end up not doing many hours. So it just might be that it's just a phase of your life right now. You're going through a phase of some days or a week or a period where a lot of things are going on in your mind. And then it's okay. Just to be here, just relax, try to meditate a little bit, and don't put any big expectation on yourself. If your mind is very active, just be here. Just relax. Enjoy the sun. Sleep enough. Recover as much as you can. And then maybe next time you're not so emotional, and then you'll be able to meditate more. Just be really kind to yourself. So there's only one more question, which I'll put. There's 3 questions, I think, which is the same. There's 2 questions here which I will group up, or maybe 3. I can read them out. And then I think we're done for tonight. How can meditation help us adjust to new roles in our lives, such as a spouse or a patient, maybe? Patient. What's a good method to use when time is limited in order to maintain a daily practice? So basically, how do you practice at home when there are a lot of things happening? And the other question, I believe my job is stressful. I have to deal with many staff and stakeholders, plus coordinate multiple things at the same time, which does not help me very much to keep my mind still. How can I become more like this turtle I was talking about the first day? When I have a job, which is so, which promotes a jumpy, edgy, nervous mind. So basically, those and then the same here. I'm having difficulty incorporating meditation into my daily routine. Like how do you do this thing when you're out of your retreat and you're coming back to your to your home and to your work, and how do you practice? And I actually have a pretty good answer for that. And that answer is not was told by me, because a few weeks ago, I went to Thailand to visit one of the friends of Ajahn Brahm, the spiritual director of BSWA, and it's a Thai monk. And his name is Ajahn Ganha. He's a good friend of Ajahn Brahm. And I went there for 20 days just to listen to another teacher. I've been here for 12 years now, and I had Ajahn Brahm as a teacher continuously. And I wanted to listen to another wise monk. And when when I was there, he was hammering one specific thing, one aspect, which he thinks is kind of done wrong in the West, amongst Western lay practitioners. Because I see all these questions here. How do I keep meditating? How can I implement meditation in my life? How can I find time for meditation? And I recognized this right away. And I was the same when I was a layperson in Norway. It was all about meditation. That's the key. You should go home, and then you do your meditation at home, and then everything will be fine. But when I came here, and I studied enough the teachings of the Buddha, I realized that this is not actually about only meditation. There is an Eightfold Path to be developed, and meditation is one of those eight factors. And this friend of Ajahn Brahm, who called Ajahn Ganha, he was so on that, trying to teach all the Western guests he had a lot of guests coming from China and Hong Kong, and what we call Westerners from Australia and Europe, in addition to all the Thais who comes to him for advice. And when he's talking to people from Australia and from Europe, he's always hammering this thing that what you're supposed to be doing is not necessarily just to go home and meditate. You're supposed to develop the Eightfold Path. And meditation is the eighth factor of those factors. It's just one of them. We are so conditioned by teachers in the West, whether they are lay teacher or they're monastic teachers, they're always telling you to be mindful and do meditation. Just do meditation, just be mindful. But that was not what the Buddha was teaching. He was teaching what he called the Eightfold Path. And in the Eightfold Path, there are a lot of right intention, that's the second factor. Being kind, that's one of the factors in the Eightfold Path. Develop your kindness. You don't need to sit in your office and do meditation in a busy environment. You can develop another of those eight factors at work. You can develop kindness. Kindness to your co-workers. Kindness to those people you're meeting. That's one factor. And it's also important. And then the third and the fourth and the fifth factor is basically virtue. Not to damage anything, to restrain yourself, not to lie, not to have bad speech. So basically virtue, that's the third and fourth and the fifth factor of the Eightfold Path. And that is something you can practice in daily life. Just make sure that when you live and you are with your family and you're developing, you're kind of living a normal family life, make sure that you develop your precepts, you keep your precepts. According to the Buddha, those are factors which are maybe equally important to meditation. And then we have the sixth factor, which is basically, they translate it as right effort, which is, okay, it's an okay translation. It's about being aware of what's going on inside your mind. And if there's some unwholesome states of mind arising, like anger or some greed, then work on that and change it. So when you're at work and you are working, you're doing something, and you sit there in front of your desk and you're really angry because something has happened, it's part of the practice then to be aware of that happening in your mind and try to change it. Deliberately disconnect from those thoughts which creates anger and negativity in you and swap to another TV channel. Try to see something positive. So there are so many things you can do outside on a retreat. You can develop right intention, kindness. You can develop your virtue.
you can be aware of your mind and learn to increase the awareness of your mind so you can react and correct your mind and always swap bad, wholesome and bad mental states with good mental states. You don't need to sit in your office and close your eyes and focus on your breath. That's just one of the factors. And you can develop mindfulness. So I see that, and the first factor is about right view. Try to understand the Four Noble Truths. Get a good intellectual, theoretical understanding of the core teachings of the Buddha. And then the last factor is meditation. And that's just one of eight factors. So when people are conditioned to, okay, what you're supposed to do is meditation, meditation, meditation. Go home and you have to meditate, meditate, meditate. Yeah, you are supposed to do that. But there's so many other things as well which you can put effort into, which is needed to be done. This friend of Ajahn Brahma Sanghana, he said that it's like there's eight exams you should not fail doing. There's eight exams in your life which you have to pass. And that is these eight factors. And you have to pass all of them, not just one of them, which is meditation. So the practice you can do at home is much wider than just meditation. So just find a good book somewhere which present nicely the Eightfold Path, and you will find a lot of stuff there which you can apply, you can start to develop in normal life. And that is, you can do it while you're working, while you're driving, while you're caring for your kids. Meditation, then you need to kind of sit by yourself and close your eyes in your bedroom or somewhere. But that is just one of the factors. So what this teacher in Thailand were trying to hammer in and condition Westerners is that it's more than meditation to be done. So that will be my answer to all those people who are struggling with incorporating meditation in your life. Incorporate the Eightfold Path instead of. And that's much easier because you can do it while you're living your normal life. Okay? So now I've been going on for 1.5 hour, and I think that's enough.
Thank you.
Cool. So have a nice evening. If you want to, you can continue to meditate. And then let's see what's happening next. Tomorrow morning, 6:30, if you want to come with chanting. And then there will be a Dhamma talk 8:30, and that will be guided meditation and something about loving kindness and metta meditation. Okay? Cool. Have a nice evening.